Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 151, recorded Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. This is the podcast given the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: traveler data leaks and Brittany street food. So coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, for the last time. Not the last time for Travel Commons, just the last time for the studios outside of Chicago. We're picking up stakes and moving about 20 miles east-northeast to Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood, hence the reason for the short cycle on this episode. We'll be breaking down and packing up the studio and production bay this week, and probably won't have everything reassembled until the end of this month. The recording isn't really the issue. I could always go back to my roots and find a spare bathroom to record in. Just some random Starbucks or something. It's more about the production. I'm not sure I want to shrink my workflow down from a beefy dual 22-inch monitor Windows 10 mini tower rig to my 2014 vintage 11-inch MacBook Air. That feels a little difficult. Being consumed by the move logistics vortex also means I haven't done any real travel in the couple of weeks since the last episode, but given that my most recent travel experiences, as laid out in last episode's Travel Interruptus epic, given that, I've kind of appreciated the break, especially when yet another April snowstorm blew up 700 flights last weekend. Instead, I've been wrestling once again with Avios, the British Airways, Iberia, and now Aer Lingus frequent flyer program, trying to book a Chicago, Dublin, Edinburgh Aer Lingus itinerary for my daughter's graduation from University of St. Andrews next month. You know, I've been pretty vocal about my challenges with Avios over the years, but in this go-around, really the first wackiness was just trying to use the Avios website. To search for flights, you need to log in with, you know, some Avios program credentials, BA, Iberia, Aer Lingus. So I try with all three. And I fail with all three. Seems that the passwords given out by BA and Iberia don't meet the Avios security rules, so they fail. Interesting. I assumed that the username for my Aer Lingus account was my email address, and the password seems strong enough. But that kept failing too. Finally, after digging around my Aer Lingus profile, I found a separate username, which I'd never seen or used before, and lo and behold, that worked. Well, then I finally got through that gate, which then put me right onto that second wackiness. The difference between the value of an Avios point on the Aer Lingus and Avios websites. Now, the award offers on both sites were points plus cash. So taking the market rate for the ticket, which I pulled from Expedia, subtracting out the required cash payment, and then dividing by the number of required Avios points gives the value of the Avios point for that award offer. My rule of thumb is get at least 2 cents per point or pay cash. The Aer Lingus site valued an Avios point at 0.7 cents, while the Avios site hit my 2 cent minimum. I couldn't quite understand that 65% difference, but I booked our tickets on the wonkier Avios site before it went away. I mean, if I remember anything from my University of Chicago Business School courses, it's that markets are efficient. 65% price differences won't last forever. Though in this case, the difference may linger because the Avios website makes it so damn hard to find. So following up, veteran, as opposed to longtime, I'll now switch to veteran Travel Commons listener, Mika Prakala. And I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation of Mika's last name, so I apologize. Anyhow, Mika, I'll go by your first name, sent in a note this week talking about his great experience with a flight rebooking service called Freebird. Mika writes, I was flying with a companion from Wichita to St. Louis and then St. Louis to Detroit Metro. Just as the plane was descending to St. Louis, I received text messages from Southwest and Freebird that the St. Louis-Detroit leg on Southwest had been canceled. Freebird then manually advised that the only flight for the day was a Delta St. Louis to Detroit flight, and they were going to book it in case I wanted it. If they waited any longer, they might not have enough time to issue the new ticket on Delta through their travel agent. They just asked me to confirm that I, in fact, wanted the Delta ticket. I confirmed we wanted the two Delta tickets, and by the time the door opened in St. Louis, we had a confirmation number to check in for the Delta flight that was leaving in 47 minutes. We got seats together on the Delta flight that were assigned by the Freebird process, and they even gave us free drinks. I think we actually arrived in Detroit a few minutes earlier than we were scheduled to on the original flight, and hey, it made for a great travel story and adventure. And this was my first time using Freebird as well. It costs $19 to protect a one-way trip per traveler. It's simple to work with them. Unlike insurance, there are no claims forms, long waits, or papers to sign. Mika, thanks very much for this. I had not heard of Freebird before your note. Hitting their website, they're selling their service to companies, travel agencies, and individual travelers. Clicking through to a TechCrunch article about them from their website, it says they're also talking to Amex and Citibank about including Freebird as a credit card benefit. The article quotes the CEO, Ethan Bernstein, saying, it's funny what happens when people deal with uncertainty. Uncertainty is the worst. As soon as you give people information, human support, and technology to help them solve their problems, they experience the event so much differently. Which is exactly right. Certainty lets you plan. Uncertainty just leaves you to stew and drink at the airport bar, and eat bad airport food, and bitch tweet. Yep, uncertainty leads to a lot of bad things. One fun thing on last month's trip was getting to try out an alpha version of a new augmented reality feature for Google Maps. I used it first in Stockholm. We got off the Arlanda Express at the Central train station and wanted to make our way over to Östermalm's market hall, Salud Hall, for lunch. When I chose walking as our transport mode, a Start AR button showed up next to the usual button to start the directions. With that augmented reality with AR, I'd hold my phone up and the display would use the camera to show the streetscape in front of me with the directions, street names, arrows, kind of overlaid on the real-time image. I thought it was a nice ad. I mean, it reduced any ambiguity about where the next turn was. One interesting feature, when I started walking, the screen dimmed and a message popped up telling me to stop looking at the phone and look straight ahead. I mean, all in all, it was kind of fun. At least I thought so. You know, Andrew and Irene were much less impressed. I mean, it worked very well for what was billed as an alpha product. It'll be interesting to see how it develops and how fast Google rolls it out. But even without a broader AR rollout, Google Maps seems to be on track to become the next sort of super app, you know, kind of the Western counterpart to China's WeChat, kind of, you know, a Swiss Army knife kind of it does everything app. Now, Google Maps isn't to that level yet, but it's growing. I mean, if you think about it, it started out as a mapping app, then added driving directions, then rideshare, I mean, showing Uber and Lyft prices, then public transit directions with real-time arrival times, which ended up replacing kind of the core use case for apps like Transit. Then the Explore Nearby buttons became more prominent, which for me has really kind of supplanted Yelp when looking for a restaurant because, well, it's just that much more convenient. And then with deep links to OpenTable for reservations, and then for nearby hotels, direct booking links to Expedia and Booking.com. I mean, I wasn't surprised when I saw a stat that those near me searches grew 150% last year. Now, I'm not quite sure what I think about all this. I mean, loving a free service that keeps becoming more valuable versus becoming more enslaved to the Google overlords. I mean, back in episode 132, I listed all the travel apps on my smartphone, and Google Maps was the most important. I said at the time, indeed, it's the only travel app with its own screen real estate rather than sharing space in the travel folder. And it only just keeps getting more indispensable. I don't know. With Lyft hitting their IPO and Uber lining up for their IPO, got me thinking back to our last day in Paris when both Ubers that we ordered were nice black Mercedes. And I just couldn't help thinking about how the quality of U.S. Uber and Lyft vehicles, quite honestly, has slipped. I mean, I remember when I started using Uber 4 to 5 years ago, the cars were pristine. I remember working in Baltimore one summer. I was more than happy to wait the 5 minutes for an Uber rather than taking one of the cabs waiting at the stand right outside the building I was working in. I mean, those cabs were so beat up, so full of trash, most of the times without working air conditioning. I mean, today cabs haven't gotten much cleaner, but I got to tell you, the Uber and Lyft seem to be lowering their standards, and so the gap between them and cabs isn't quite what it used to be. I don't know if it's because of falling unemployment rates or trying to keep up with growth or squeezing drivers to pay to improve their post-IPO margins, or maybe it's all of the above. But I have to tell you, I don't know about you guys, but I'm seeing a real drop in quality. Longtime or veteran Travel Commons listeners will recall that I have spent a lot of time in New Orleans Airport over the years, and other than serving a beer in Go Cups, French Quarter style, so you can walk around the terminal with it, there's not much good to say about that airport, especially with regards to food and restaurants. And for such a great food town to have such mediocre airport concessions has always been beyond me. But, you know, I don't know. Then again, the original terminal was built in 1959 and then expanded in the mid-70s and the mid-90s. So the new $1 billion, that's a billion with a B, the new $1 billion replacement terminal was originally scheduled to open last year during New Orleans tricentennial, but then it slipped to February of this year and then to this month, and now kind of a to-be-determined date sometime in the fall. The restaurant selection is supposed to be much better, but what I really hope is that they don't change that beer policy. I mean, one time, waiting out yet another thunderstorm delay there, I'd bought a beer and was kind of standing by the gate drinking it because the bar was full. American called boarding, and I walked up to the gate. The agent stopped me. She said, "You know, you can drink that beer anywhere in the airport except on this jetway." I looked down. I'd forgotten that I was still carrying a beer. I stepped to the side, chugged it, and then got on the plane. I mean, I don't know. It kind of felt like a very New Orleans thing to do. Hey, and if you have any travel rants, questions, a story, a comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can always send in an audio comment, a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can post your comments on the website at travelcommons.com. And the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is traveler data leaks. And to talk about this, I invited Candid West, principal threat researcher at Symantec and author of a recent blog post titled, take a deep breath, 2 in 3 hotel websites leak guest booking details and allow access to personal data. Candid, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
One of the reasons, Candid, I wanted to talk to you was you just posted at the beginning of April a piece about hotel websites leaking booking data and allowing access to personal data. 2/3 of the sites, you said, which is not an insignificant percentage. I guess the first question is how did you find this?
Well, I guess it's similar as to you. I travel a lot, Mark, and therefore I, of course, have to do a lot of bookings, being it for airlines, but of course also a lot of hotel bookings. And since on my day job, I'm a security analyst, I of course check, is my data really secure? And I had a few stories in the past where I thought, that definitely doesn't sound right. And now I had the time to actually investigate a bit further. And in the end, I analyzed kind of different hotel chains, which adds up to 1,500 different hotels. And as you said, unfortunately, about 2 out of 3 do in some way leak your data. So that's the scary part. But I guess it's just daily work and running with open eyes.
So, Candid, what does this mean to the typical traveler? When you think about your findings and then sort of translate them into the day-to-day, your day-to-day, our day-to-day, what does it really mean?
For my research, in quotes, only access to your booking was given, which means that if you do a hotel booking somewhere, an attacker might actually be able to look into that booking and see maybe your post address, maybe it's your phone number, your email address, your passport number. For international travel, sometimes that's required. And of course, worrying is as well, if they have a grudge against you, they could actually cancel your booking. So it's more about the nuisance. And of course, in today's age, not everyone wants their email address or phone number being leaked to God knows who.
Well, it sounds like it could be one input into some identity theft.
Absolutely, yes. So identity theft would be kind of first step, getting a lot of information. But we also seen some personalized spam and scam emails. So just imagine you actually book a trip, maybe in Montreal, and then 2 days later you receive an email saying, oh, Mark, thank you for your booking, but there has been some, some changes. Please open the attached document to find further details. So because there is kind of a connection to it, you're probably more inclined to click on it, right? Because there is a connection.
You know, you're absolutely right, Candid. I hadn't thought about that. As we said, travel security seems to be kind of an area of interest or research for you. Have you seen any improvements in traveler data security?
Yeah, I would say I've seen some improvements, but it's definitely not there where it should be. And it's not an easy task because, of course, we as travelers, we want to have it very convenient, right? You want that single click link that puts you to all your boarding passes and everything else. So we don't really want the hassle of verification codes and stuff. But on the other hand, it has to be secured. And one of the reasons why it didn't change too much is whenever you do a booking, you will receive one of those 6-character alphanumerical codes, which is the booking reference number or booking reference code. And that's kind of your unique identifier for the whole systems. Unfortunately, 6 characters and usually your last name, that's not enough of information to actually make it very secure.
Any suggestions then on what a frequent traveler should do to make their data more secure? What do you do to protect yourself?
I think there's some easy steps that you can take beginning even before you start your journey. And one is, don't share that booking reference code with the world. Don't post photos of your tickets on Instagram or Twitter and say, hey, I'm about to fly to Hawaii. Because on the ticket, there is that code. Sometimes it's in a barcode. Sometimes you actually see the figures. And of course, your name is on there as well. And that means that anyone seeing the picture could actually log in and also cancel your booking, maybe change your frequent flyer miles numbers and so on. So, and the same is for, don't throw away those baggage tags that you might have received, or even just a stop from your ticket if you have a paper ticket. Because again, on those small ticket pieces, it's the same information and it's the same code for your journey back as well. So just guard this information is kind of the first step, of course. The second one I would say is whenever you're on the road, being at the airport, hotel, or anywhere, make sure that if you connect to the Wi-Fi, that you're actually protecting the connections. And the simplest way would be to use a VPN, one of those virtual private network software, which adds another encryption layer on top. Because otherwise, anyone in the same Wi-Fi hotspot, so it could be the airport itself, can actually see what you do if the website is not encrypted. And again, I saw 29% of the hotels do not encrypt their connections, which means that anyone else could actually see that you're booking something and again, see all your information. So those would be two simple steps that hopefully make your journey a lot more comfortable.
Candid, very good recommendations. And they're very easy recommendations. Certainly just taking care of the information and being mindful of sharing that information. And then secondly, and we've talked about it on this podcast before, around using a VPN on public Wi-Fi, even if you think the websites are encrypted through HTTPS, you don't always have that view about what's encrypted and what's not. So easier and safer just to use that VPN. Well, Candid, thank you very much for taking this time. Thanks for writing the blog posts on this. I'll keep track of your research because it's interesting for those of us who spend a lot of time in airports, train stations, hotels, and rental cars. So thank you very much.
Thank you as well, and safe travel to everyone.
Check out the show notes for links to Candid's article and his Twitter account. Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is Brittany street food. So I'll write a proper road trip post about our Brittany trip later this spring after we get settled in the new digs. But after streaming a few episodes of Netflix street food series, I started thinking about some of the Breton street food we enjoyed while touring there last month. I mean, if you've seen any of the Netflix series, you'll know that it's really more about the vendors and their stories than it is about the food. But I have to tell you, I have to admit my French trail off after oui, non, merci, and s'il vous plaît. And so I wasn't able to get much of the vendor's life stories. So this topic is going to be, I don't know, all about the food. So the first place we stayed was Cancale, and we went there for one reason. Oysters, like people have been doing for 300 some odd years. I mean, when the tide is out, you can see miles of oyster beds with big farm tractors moving through the rows, hauling out trailers of oysters, and then lining the ramp where the tractors drive up out of the oyster beds is a little oyster market. There's 8 stalls selling oysters fresh from those beds for 5 to 6 euros a dozen. And after adding, you know, maybe a euro or two for shucking and half a lemon and the use of a plastic platter, we had our afternoon snack sitting on the seawall by the market, slurping down a couple of dozen very briny oysters while watching the tractors do their work, and then pitching the empty shells back onto the beach for the seagulls to pick through. Now, our first afternoon that we did this, we only had a couple of cans of beer in our jacket pockets. The next couple of afternoons, though, we'd pour some nice, you know, pour nice white wine into a couple of empty plastic Evian bottles. Didn't want to bring glass down on the seawall. Claire and I preferred a nice crisp Sancerre. And then we also made sure we had a really good supply of wet wipes, wet naps. I have to tell you, it was one of the highlights of our trip. We did not miss a single afternoon sitting on that seawall with the oysters while we were in Cancale. Buckwheat is a big thing in Brittany. Who knew? It's been grown in Brittany apparently for, I don't know, half a millennium or more. And for almost that long, it seems, has been turned into a galette, a buckwheat crepe. But It's a crepe in form and shape only, because instead of the soft white wheat flour crepe filled with jam or Nutella that we're kind of used to here, the galette is crisper, firmer, and it's savory. You know, it's fine on its own, smeared with some bread and butter, or with, say, a ham or egg or cheese or really anything sort of savory inside. We got into Concarneau, which is on the southwest coast of Brittany, about an hour before the weekly Friday outdoor market closed. I counted about a half dozen galette trucks. We walked up to the closest one. The cook was finishing up what looked like a weekend's worth of galettes for the person in front of us, flipping them, then pulling them off two hot metal discs, buttering them, and then adding them to the stack. It was Friday in Lent, so I went for the egg, onion, and cheese galette. I mean, the creaminess of that cheese played really nicely against the graininess of the buckwheat, and, you know, wrapped up nicely. It was a great snack to spend the rest of the time walking around the market. The next day, we drove to Rennes, which was our last stop in Brittany. We dropped the rental car at the train station and then took the subway to Place de Lise for what is a huge, huge Saturday market. They say it's the second largest market in France. We walked down from the subway station down through the fruit and vegetable stands that line the street. You know, beautiful, beautiful stuff, but we were leaving the next day, so we weren't doing a whole lot of green grocery shopping. But there, between the two market halls, it was a collection of food trucks, and about 70% of them were selling what we were looking for: galette saucisse, the classic Breton street food that is pretty much what the straight translation from French to English suggests: a sausage in a galette. Kind of like a Breton hot dog. It's a cooked pork sausage wrapped in a cool buckwheat galette, maybe with some grilled onions and then some Dijon mustard added on top. I mean, there were lines tailing back from all the trucks serving these. A local guy pointed one truck out to Irene. "They're the best," he said. So she and Claire stood in that queue while Andrew and I searched for drinks. Around the corner, we found a local cider maker. A couple of tables that he had were surrounded by just stacks, crates of cider bottles. And through kind of some mangled bit of franglais, we bought a bottle of dry cider that had stayed cool in the shade and four plastic cups. Opened the bottle there and then got back to the food truck line just in time to be handed my galette saucisse. After finishing the sausage and cider, I swung past the cider stand, went back to him to give him the empty bottle, kind of in-person recycling. There wasn't much time to catch up on his life story, but it was a sunny Saturday and he had a full line. So, I don't know, he looked like he was having a good day too. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 151. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to say subscribe. Check out the show notes for music links. Find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Alexa, iTunes, and Spotify. I got to check out Google Play nowadays. I've always had problems with them. I got to check that out again. The links along with the RSS feed are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that in the social media section are links to the Travel Commons Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. And if you've already subscribed, I appreciate you leaving us a review on any of those sites that you get your podcasts from. Thanks for everybody who has done that. It helps grow the listenership, as you might say. And then if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file, comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or mpeacock on Twitter, the Travel Commons page on Facebook, Travel Commons Instagram site. Post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has sent in emails like Mika, tweets, or posted comments on the website. And for the last time, from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Take care. Bye now.